World War One in Our Minds, A Historical View by T. Hunt Tooley, an Audiomesis Daily narrated by Robert Hale. The 50th anniversary of the First World War in 1964 felt nothing like the current centennial observances. It is worth asking what has changed. When I was growing up in the 60s in a small town in Texas, World War I seemed as remote to me as the Revolutionary War. Not that the conflict was unknown to me. In our city park, there was a statue of a First World War soldier and a memorial to hometown sons who had died in the war. And my grandmother and grandfather told me stories of relief and celebration in 1918 at the war's end. At school, the dumbing down of social studies was already well underway, but my teachers did mention the war, though with few details included. Most of those possessed of a public school education in the mid-60s had at least a chance of encountering Alan Seeger's poem, I Have a Rendezvous with Death, and I had heard of historical episodes like the Lost Battalion. But by 1964, World War I was always in the shadow of World War II. With its death rendezvous and lost battalions, the First World War was pretty much a downer, while the Good War was a poignant but ennobling upper. The Good War seemed to overwhelm everything with all the movies, the survivors, the stories, Glorious Normandy, The Bulge, and all the rest. But even when blinded by the brightness of the Good War, many educated Americans remembered the great revisionist controversies of the 20s and 30s. In the immediate wake of the First War, a number of American historians produced histories demonstrating that the Germans were hardly the only power to deserve blame for the coming of the war. These revisionists, Sidney B. Fay, Charles Beard, Harry Elmer Barnes, H.C. Engelbrecht, and Bernie Hannigan and others, revised much of the received history put out by the Entente governments and the patriotic historians who supported the party line. Since we now call numerous schools of historical interpretation in the United States revisionist, I will call this early revisionist tradition, with a nod to Paul Gottfried, paleo-revisionists. These historians brought different perspectives to the history of their time, but one commonality was that they all pretty much decried the war as a European affair which the United States should have left alone. This movement swelled until the glorious waves of World War II interventionism simply washed over doubts and questions about World War I. Yet the 1960s was also a turning point in the American consideration of World War I, at least in some respects. Quite apart from the paleo-revisionist history of the war's origins, the 50th anniversary brought forth all kinds of commemorative material, and especially some great first-hand accounts. In this regard, perhaps the most outstanding book is the collection of survivors' essays edited by George Panichus, The Promise of Greatness, The War of 1914 to 1918, published 1968. Everything taken together, this was no flood, but in spite of the American public's previous lack of interest, there was some fine and evocative writing that came out in response to the anniversary. Meanwhile, in German universities, the 60s brought a stormy historiographical controversy known as the Fischer Thesis Debate, a debate which hung on newly examined German documents, which seemed to show that the Germans were totally guilty in starting the war after all, hence the debate. Now, only a few American students of modern Europe knew anything of this dispute. Still, the European controversy and the 50th anniversary memorial writing did arouse interest among scholars, and a few began to rethink World War I. One of these, Colombian historian René Albrecht Carri, wrote a small history of the war aimed at a broad audience, The Meaning of the First World War, 1965. His book was brief, theme-centered, and even uninformative about many aspects of the war, the military part, for example. But Albrecht Carri made one central point persuasively. The First World War was the profound event of the 20th century world. The great upheavals of the century, he asserted in somewhat Tolkien-esque idiom, came from the deeper forces which broke through in the years 1916 and 1917. Increased American interest in a forgotten period also showed in the collection of mainstream historians' opinions in the 1967 book edited by Jack Roth, World War I, A Turning Point in Modern History. By the time I got to college in the early 70s, a couple of young, energetic history professors I encountered had picked up on this new trend, emphasizing in many ways the centrality of World War I to modern history. Even if most of the renewed study of the war was not revisionist, however, much of it harmonized quite well with the paleo-revisionist approach, especially in the revisionist goals of investigating neglected aspects of history and of attempting to look beyond patriotic glorifications of the conflict. Much in the new studies also harmonized with revisionism by emphasizing agency and individuality among soldiers and other groups normally treated collectively. John Keegan was nowhere near the revisionist camp, but his 1976 book, The Face of Battle, introduced a whole new interest in individual motivation on the battlefield. Keegan's whole approach was to explore the faces and the faceless mass of British soldiers, in this case at the Battle of Somme. Trench Warfare 1914 to 1918, The Live and Let Live System, published 1980, Tony Ashworth's intense appraisal of soldiers' informal truces during the war, was another example of a book with fairly broad circulation that delved into individual rather than mass behavior and motivation. And perhaps most importantly, the great literary historian Paul Fussell gave the world his masterpiece, The Great War and Modern Memory, in 1975, thereby emphasizing the profoundly individual analysis of individual suffering and memory as against state-mediated memorials. One way or the other, since the late 80s, European historiographical trends and this fairly broad American appreciation of the importance of the war ignited what has been a steady cottage industry in books about the 1914 to 1918 war. Yale historian Jay Winter helped create a very influential PBS documentary series, The Great War and the Shaping of the 20th Century, in 1996. Indeed, Winter and numerous international scholars have reinvigorated the field of World War I studies from the 90s onward. One of the most important influences on paleo-revisionists after 1945 was Ludwig von Mises. His contributions consisted not so much of detailed studies as of the theoretical analysis which put the war into context of the growing state. This analysis appeared in his wartime book, Omnipotent Government, but also the earlier Nation, State, and Economy, and many other works. Mises really offered the revisionist school a theoretical framework which had been missing. He also encouraged many students in this direction, including Murray N. Rothbard and Ralph Rako. Rothbard contributed very substantially to the field of technical studies of World War I as he folded the theory of Mises into the older revisionist school. His works on war collectivism, war as fulfillment, the financial history of the war, and other topics stand at center stage in modern paleo-revisionism. Indeed, Rothbard really expanded the agenda of revisionism to encompass a variety of new topics in intellectual, economic, and social history relative to the first conflict. Along with Mises, Rothbard took revisionism in a direction away from the unqualified support of Germany under the Kaiser, a kind of caricature position in which some revisionists had become stuck. Rothbard critiqued the state as state, including the German version of it. In this renewed tradition, the works of Ralph Rako, Robert Higgs, Jeff Riggenbach, Hans Hermann Hoppe, Richard Gamble, Paul Gottfried, Thomas Woods, Joseph Stromberg, and others expanded the materials and subjects of revisionist studies of the war, giving new life to an older school of thought very much parallel to the reemergence of Austrian economics as a dynamic, rigorous system of scholarly thought. There is still much to do, but Austrian-minded historians from various disciplines now have a much broader platform to work from. Though I probably tend to be a glass-half-full judge of historical analysis and social progress, considering the changes I have witnessed from the 50th anniversary to the 100th, I think the picture of the First World War in our minds is fuller and more accurate, the result of a quantum leap in historical knowledge and analysis from the 50th to the 100th anniversary of that massive conflict. Like the battalion, this past was not really lost, just hard to get to. The Mises Institute hopes you have enjoyed this audio Mises Daily. For a world of free market literature, media, and discussion, visit Mises.org.